After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
All right. Hey, listeners. It's been a while, hasn't it? So, first of all, a belated happy Black History Month to everybody. I could not let this month go by without delivering something. So me and Sky are here to, you know, as you can tell by the title, we will be delivering our review and extended discussion of, I think, when did it come out last? It came out last year, right? Jeffrey Reif starring in American Fiction?
Yeah, it came out at the end of the year.
At the end of the year? Okay. So we're not too late to see it, I hope. But yeah, just wanted to reassure everybody, we're still here. It's been a crazy year. I don't know how else to say it, and it seems trite to say it like this, but it does not feel like we're in the same world as only a few months ago, right?
Yeah, everything feels weird, to say the least.
To say the least. And I mean, we will be back with more, you know, political coverage, society and culture discussions, and you know, we got stuff that we want to get to, but to be perfectly frank with everybody, everyone's good, everyone's okay, but you know, the nature of running a podcast as it is, it's just not everyone's first priority, so we try to get to it when we get to it. So fingers crossed, we still have a good year for everybody. We will still be here to deliver the hot content no one else will do for free. But yeah, it's just, I don't know about the listeners, but me personally, I've had to take a step back from the internet too. And I don't know if it's like fair to chalk this up entirely to, you know, individual entrepreneurs like Musk, even though like we have talked about their outsized influence in the tech space and how online spaces are kind of twisted by their dictates and such, right? But I mean, we're starting to see like a weird like decline in the quality of the golden age of social media, and even like we're seeing like, I mean, on YouTube as a separate point, right? Like big channels are just quitting left and right, you know? Twitter is not the same environment it used to be. Instagram has gotten more crazy from what I can tell. And I don't know. I don't know what can be said reliably about the new internet we're in. But it's not amenable to good content anymore.
Yeah, they don't want you to have a community and have good content and talk to each other about your similarities.
Yeah, everything's bye, and you know, be afraid of anybody who looks like remotely different from you. It's the most low rent, toxic environment, you know.
Truly is.
Yeah. This is where I think it pays to hit the books a little bit, just because the question of how exactly did we get here is the one that's always on my mind. And I've been finding that to be rewarding in some sense. Is it praxis? I don't know. But I think, you know, part of greenhouse mindset has always been, you know, be critical of your use of the internet, expand your mind. And now, like, I don't know if everybody feels this way, but I think I just hit a wall with the way the algorithm was working on me, or whether it was my particular feed or whatever it was. It just hit a point where it's like, this is driving me insane. I can't do this. Not in like a conspiracy way, but it's just like, I can't use this. I can't use this anymore. So yeah, I mean, overall, it's just do a quick vibe check, you know. What is the vibe in this moment at present? Let's practice a little mindfulness, vibefulness.
I don't know how to answer that.
That's okay. That's okay. You know, I think there's notes of apprehension, a slight soupçon of nervousness, and just an overall sense of this is a classic. This is a great $100 world word, malaise. Let's move to drink check. What are we drinking right now?
Water.
Good, good. That's the right choice. I got a knockoff Dr. Pepper here. let's probably just jump straight into the movie, huh? So, I actually didn't see a lot of press about this movie from the jump. I don't know if it's because like my algorithm's weird, or if like I'm just not paying attention to the usual channels about film and whatnot. But it was kind of understated, and I wonder if that's because it's an Amazon project. What do you think?
No.
No?
Well, first, Black Twitter talked about it.
Okay,
so.
Okay. There's my mistake right there.
And I don't think it's... The idea of that it's an Amazon, MGM Amazon Studios thing, and that makes people not talk about it is ridiculous. People talk about movies no matter who produces them or
then maybe I'm
whatever. Yeah, it's not that it wasn't talked about. It was talked about, but it was only released in a few theaters when it first came out, and then it's getting Oscar nominations allowed it to be opened up to more theaters. So that's kind of how, like, it was supposed to be a very indie movie that got more fame after it came out.
Deservedly.
Which allowed it to branch out in other theaters.
Yeah, and that's like, I mean, I'm showing my ass here, which when am I not? Because I haven't been keeping up with awards coverage and I missed out on the Oscar stuff, but it truly is like a brilliant film. It's like it's kind of perfect for the times almost. In the sense of it kind of captures the kind of diseased nature of how art and media is not only sold, but even like made popular and how it's conceived of today. And it's an adaptation of, I think a book from the 90s called Erasure.
It was, I think, 2001.
2001. Okay. So yeah. And from what I was able to look up, I think most of the plot beats are the same, but I cannot speak for that exactly because I haven't read the book, but it's telling that a book from 2001, even if adapted, you know, 23 years later, is still presciently relevant. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, overall, I think... I didn't even hear about it until like I think our friends Zareen and Justin like brought it up at the Super Bowl, and then you got us tickets to go see it, and I wasn't exactly expecting a poor film. I just didn't know what to expect going in.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out, you know, thoroughly impressed. It's brilliant. What were your thoughts of the film overall?
I thought it was very telling of a lot of just media, entertainment. I think it was very funny in ways that people would not see it funny if you're not Black or you haven't been around Black people. And it was interesting to go to the movie because it was a smaller theater. It was, we went on a Wednesday. It was like, or Thursday. It was only a few people. And we were in a theater, like, with the other people were mostly white and this other Black gentleman. And, like, we were laughing at times they weren't laughing. It's just, like, that part was also, like, that adds to the experience being around white people who might not get that they are a part of the joke in that moment, which makes it even better.
Yeah, that the audience, like, reaction to a film is a calculated thing people don't take into account when they watch a movie. But it really was a cultural experience, you know, seeing that movie. And I think that's why, like, I had that when I saw, like, the Amazon logo on, like, at the start of the movie. There's something in my mind about, like, you know, it's very weird that, you know, these big companies with, like, really restrictive practices when it comes to how they operate in the marketplace are also somehow willing to, like, push the envelope when it comes to their content. And I wonder, like, you know, what forces allow them to do that, right? Because, like, as we're seeing with things like Netflix, you know, Netflix's CEO was, like, a big, like, charter school advocate. And we've seen them, like, really tamp down how far they push the envelope with their content. Hulu's all over the place with their stuff. I don't know what their ownership situation is. But people have talked about just, like, you know, Prime Video in general and how with things like The Boys, you know, they're willing to, I mean, I haven't kept up with it past season one, but, you know, the fact that they're willing to satirize the oversaturation of the market with, like, superhero media and the fact that it kind of is willing to go there with stuff about, like, corporate domination and control. And it has a lot of, like, you know, envelope pushing content is something that people have brought up. And it's, like, it's crazy that Amazon is willing to do that. And that was a big, like, thought in my head watching this movie is just repeatedly, I'm thinking, damn, they really went there. And I kind of wonder, like, what it is about, and it's not even relevant to the film, right? But I kind of wonder what it is about doing all this market control just to, like, trickle out content that is willing to push the envelope. I don't know what that's about, but it's something to observe.
I mean, the thing is I don't think, well, how do I say this? I think if it was not created like a producer of Amazon, they would have been a little bit more they would have been meaner if, but they also didn't say too much about a certain bigwig of the industry. They just talked about it in whole. Like, yeah, so they weren't doing jabs at someone specifically, but they were, you know that they still weren't, like, being like, oh, media is so amazing and everything's so great, and if you have a good story, you'll just go there and you'll be heard and loved and everything. And you can really see that from the idea of, like, this movie came out 23 years after the book. How many times are there a book adaptation that comes out that late? Like, especially its first movie, like, that is usually not heard of. But we're just now in a place where Black people sometimes can joke about how shitty our lives are because of white people and like the powers that be.
Yeah. And even then it's like, this is Cord Jefferson's first film, I think, too. So to get the chance to take a lot of creative risks and really like have a really biting critique of the society you live in your first film, I can kind of see like why these newer like media conglomerates, like they take a chance on, you know, cutting content like this. Like if Amazon's trying to push the envelope with American Fiction, you know, Apple Films is trying to push the envelope with stuff like Killers of the Flower Moon. There's a weird duality at play where it's like these underrepresented, you know, stories and storytellers. I mean, Scorsese's a different animal in this case, right? But
mm-hmm.
I'm talking more so like Lily Gladstone in that particular instance, right? You know, if people who traditionally don't get represented, their stories don't get seen, those particular narratives are never told, and then a new player in the market is willing to say, hey, come to us, we're selling something, people can flock to it because there's a real need for it. And I think that's something that gets missed in the whole discussion about representation in media, is that whether you find it corny or whether you find it pandering to some extent, it doesn't downplay the fact that because we live in like a media saturated society, there actually is a need for representation. And because it's subject to market forces, you know, studios can play a game with it. And that is kind of the understated thesis of this book, the book and then the film more broadly, which we'll get into. So I guess we'll try to do our best to maybe walk through the plot and maybe talk through like some key moments. What did you think about the focus of it being like in Boston? Because I think like when it comes to how we conceive of most African American communities, Boston just tends to be like the dead zone.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was them truly talking about how rich the family was, because they could have been rich anywhere, and you would think like, oh, that's a lot of money to have, like you have a live-in maid, that's a lot of money. But you see their old historical Boston house and like all of the like that filled feeling home, because you have enough money to just be like, decorate this or whatever. And you go up to his childhood room and you see the lacrosse hit like sticks and Harvard posters and everything on the wall. It's telling us that this is not an average rich black family. This sounds like a black family that has generations of money, which is really funny to think about, because in the autobiography of Malcolm X, that is an area where he talks about like a group of black people who got jobs, like good jobs early on and got to be like that old black money.
Yeah.
And how pretentious and how far away those people were compared to like other black people who lived in the area. And it's just like, this is saying way, like if you would have had this black family in Metro Detroit, you would have seen that and you would have thought newer money. You would think, yeah, maybe Mac's granddad got a good job and got some generational wealth, and then the next generation really ran with that. But this isn't just saying that. This is old, old, old money. To have a house like that in Boston, old money. To be able to afford a live-in maid throughout the entire childhood and adulthood of your children, old money. And they said, like, Tracy Ellis Ross' character was 50.
Yeah.
They had been around, like, their Lorraine, their maid, had been around since their childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
That's old, rich money. Two of the kids were medical doctors and the other one had a PhD, and nobody complained at all about student loans. Like, it was building up this idea of, like, these are very rich individuals. And yeah. They're still hit by, like, all, like, money issues, especially, like, with the father committing suicide. And they, I don't think they really talk about why he commits suicide. So I'm thinking, like, maybe it is, like, maybe he was a financial person and he hit, like, something big happened, or there's a lot of things that they don't even talk about that keeps you thinking and, like, has an imagination of its own to be like, they're so rich that they have an old, beautiful Boston home and a beach home.
And they're still downwardly mobile somehow because, like, there's just no new money coming
struggling.
In.
And they're still struggling. And that, like, that says a lot.
Yeah, I think the class character of, like, Jeffrey Wright's character, what's his name?
Monk,
yeah, I forgot the family name in the film. What was it? Ellison, yeah. So, like, the Ellison family was... They were in, like, all the exposition and, like, and all we can tell is, like... They are a relatively wealthy family in Boston, one of the few Black families in Boston, right? With generational wealth. And I think their dad was, like, some kind of... Yeah, he was a male OBGYN back in the day, making house calls, cheating on his wife all around town. And I think, like, there's, like, a lot of, like, sublimated, like, positions of class, right, where it's, like... Their dad, from what I could tell, it seemed to be more like a classic American death of despair, you know, where it's like he bottles up his emotions, doesn't talk to anybody, keeps secrets from everybody. And then, you know, it seemed like depression. And that's like the scenes with his mom seem to like signify that to me, where it's like she worries for him because he's a little bit like his dad and that he walls himself off and doesn't talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like. The dynamics of the family really do mirror like upper class white families. And like, I'm not saying this to be ridiculous because The Sopranos is not like a model reference for everything. Right. But it's like, how dissimilar are the Ellisons to The Sopranos, like barring race, you know what I'm saying? And like organized crime. They're both like upper middle class, like upper class families in the East Coast. Family expectations, economic expectations, gender roles, and
cheating
and depression run rampant. And it's like you could argue that like a certain kind of bourgeois acculturation and bourgeois behavior can lead to, you know, depressive personality. I don't know if like I can't point you to the research, but like there's been enough media, fiction, TV, whatever, covering this dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, the character that Jeffrey Wright plays in this film is trying to strike it as a American writer. He wants to write American fiction writ large, and he teaches a course on American fiction, and he's trying to be neutral on the category of race, not in like a very dismissive or conservative way, but he doesn't see how a certain variety of blackness is something he has to perform to be taken credibly both as an author or as a black person, right? But that seems to be the repeated expectation and demand almost placed on him by everybody from people at the Academy to his publishers to his peers. It's like, the movie really starts with it's almost funny, and I didn't know how to take it at first until it played out, where it's like he's teaching a class on American fiction. They're talking about Southern stuff. They're talking about the language in this era is gross. You're going to see some things you don't see or you don't like. And it's like the N-word shows up in a passage, or he writes it on the board, whatever the case is. And a white student, blue hair, just stereotypical, right? starts arguing with him about his use of the word. And it's like, if this isn't even the instances that go viral on the internet or people write about in the papers where a white professor insists he has the right to say it, it's completely different, where it's like, he's not insisting he should say it or whatever. He's talking about it in the context of Southern literature of a time marked by severe racism, So that gets him kicked out of the university. He has to go to a writer's conference in Boston. He's like, well, now I'm stuck reconciling with my family in Boston too. Which was a pretty interesting way to start an inciting incident for that plot. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to expect with the basis of it being in Boston, but I actually have to say, the film was pretty beautifully shot in how it sets up these very simple landscapes, even shots within the homes kind of lovingly capture this older style of architecture, even within the homes. There'll be how the furniture's set up and the wallpaper. This is just a side note to me, right? But I found that very comforting. Every shot feels very cozy, even when it's a confrontation, even when characters are fighting, you feel like you're inside somebody's home in all these shots.
Yeah, and I think that more speaks, especially when you're in the homes, either the beach house or the Boston house, when you're in those spaces, I think you can tell that it's supposed to be because of Lorraine, their maid or housekeeper, however you want to say.
Yeah.
She keeps the home. She is their maternal figure. Yes, they have their mother, but their mother was basically there, but not there. Lorraine did their mothering.
Yeah, and I think that was an understated thing too, that if you didn't know how to interpret it or if you didn't understand what was going on, you'd miss this entirely. But it's the housekeeper ends up being a maternal figure to them. And then the security guard, when they go to the beach house, is almost a paternal figure to them too, right? And even we're jumping through the plot here and there, right? But they do become surrogate parents for the two surviving sons. Voluntarily at a point almost, right? And I think it's this it just kind of goes to show the class dynamics again, right? Where it's to attain that level of wealth, or when you are at that level of wealth and then it's time for you to parent your children, you do it at this bizarre kind of distance that fucks them up further. And the adult kids, they talk about it, they talk about how they've walled off their emotions. They don't know how to relate to people. Sometimes it's affected them in their relationships. And when he comes back to meet his sister, so getting us back to where we are in the plot, they start noticing that their mom's memory, and she's not a bad mother either, but she's distant. And then from distant to she's losing her memory.
Yeah, I think what we were seeing with her having Alzheimer's and just going deeper into the dementia, I don't think that that was very different from how they saw their mother beforehand. And it's not the dementia, it's the being like distant and maybe a little aloof, especially knowing that her husband was doing, like, having all of these affairs with all of these different people, house calls, all of this. Like, you're doing this and you're probably, instead of parenting your children, you're like thinking about all of this. You're in your own world. You're not in the world of like, I have to be a mother to the kids because they don't even have their, they don't really have their father. So I have to definitely be their mother. She's like in her own world. The monk is connected to their dad, but is so blind of like who he actually is, to the point where he was told that his dad was cheating by his sister, and he did not know that, even though his dad was his preferred parent. And it's like, you didn't know that at all, mostly because you didn't want to know. But you didn't know that because they didn't want you to know that. And you have this ideological like idea of like, this is what my dad is. My mom's kind of like distant. I don't know why. And then your siblings are connected because they feel the distance between both of your parents. And you just feel it towards your mother.
Yep. Yep. And then to top it off, like, you know, there's a couple concurrent plots. So like, maybe I'll try to accelerate the family plot and then we can move to like the writer one. Right. But, you know, he has to deal with, while his mother's health is declining, his sister suddenly dies from a heart attack. And to kind of fill in the role, we get two characters. So we get his other brother. What was his name?
Cliff,
yeah, played by Sterling K. Brown. And again, Sterling K. Brown's brilliant. Like, when I heard he was in the movie, I'm like, okay, I'm in, because I haven't explored too much of Jeffrey Wright's work, but now that I know that he was in all the like the Daniel Craig James Bond films, now I gotta see it.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, he plays the American counterpart in those, which is cool. So he's like a recently outed gay man. And he's kind of coping with all of this grief in his life, in addition to like his own problems with like casual sex and drugs. He's trying to be present, but he's not having the best go of it because like, it's a depressing situation. And then his mom like literally like says something homophobic while having like a lapse in memory. So it like, it really takes him out the mood. And he disappears for a bit before coming back into the plot. But he also exists to like provide a little context for why Monk acts the way he does in certain ways. And he provides additional context. And then also walking into the plot, we have Coraline, who's played by Erica Alexander. The last time I saw her was in Living Single.
Yeah, she, I think
she's been, looking great. She's looking great.
Yeah. Oh, she's looking absolutely amazing. Yeah, I don't think she's been in that many things. I think it's been more like smaller things. But she's absolutely amazing. And she plays this lawyer, which I love that she plays a lawyer, because in my mind, she actually is a lawyer. but she plays his love interest, and when we first see her, she's like very friendly to Monk, and then her ex comes in and it's like awkward, and she reassures Monk at a different time, at a later time, that like she's in the middle of breaking up with him and she doesn't stay where she's not wanted or where she doesn't feel connected to, which says a lot about a character. And I appreciate her saying that, because it's like, oh, so this is going to be a non, this is going to be a no nonsense type of situation. That's who she is. She's not going to just let you walk all over her and play the, I'm so sad, my sister's dead and my mommy's sick and I don't know what to do. Because it's just, you're too damn old for it.
Yeah. And she kind of like, in addition to that, she's also like the, she's able to keep up with Monk's more intellectual character. They bond over like reading and literature, and she'd even recognized him and read some of his books. So they start a bit of a relationship, right? And he's trying to basically like, I mean, I think they have a healthy relationship, definitely for a bulk of the movie until it gets weird. And that's probably where we jump to the author plot line, right? But there are parts of it where I'm trying to like figure out, like, is she a muse? Is she a distraction for him? Is she not being given the attention she needs to be given for this story? But I think that was kind of the role she was given in the plot, is like, she's able to like keep him afloat in this tough time in his life, and at least they're able to bond over literature and those intellectual pursuits, I think.
The thing is I understand, and I mean, I have this criticism about Tracy Ellis Ross's character because she died so early on, so it gives the trope of like, especially women and women of color being like plot points to help men get over their emotional trauma, right, or like all this stuff. Like, I mean, like Deadpool did that. And it's just, it's one of those situations where you're like, God, can it be something else? Could it be literally anything else? Why does it always have to be a woman dying to make a man realize that he needs to buck the fuck up? But I also appreciate that they didn't have Erica Alexander be like that. And she was more of like, she was an extension of how he saw literature and how he saw media. But she's not exactly how he sees it. So when she likes things that he doesn't like, he gets really defensive and rude, because he doesn't know how to have a normal relationship with someone where they dislike something that you like, or they like something you dislike.
And there was something about that scene that like, it was upsetting to see him go that route, but it was also like, you can kind of see the fear in his eyes of like, what if I have to sit here and explain myself? Will they even understand what I'm talking about? Will they be able to sympathize? And like, he's holding a big secret, which is like the writer plot I don't know if this is the primary or the secondary plot of this movie. But it's something that like it drives the secrets, right? So if his dad commits suicide because he was keeping the big secrets of his, you know, marital indiscretions, and his rage towards his family, you know, bottled up, right? His secret is actually a little bit more of it. I wouldn't say that rage is ever wholesome or sincere, but it's definitely for a better purpose, which is that it's not only like his lack of success, because in the initial plot, they mentioned that he hasn't published any books for quite some time, and that, you know, his books aren't like given the attention you know, they're not treated as mainstream fiction. They're treated as like black, like a separate, you know, category of black literature or black studies. Like they walk into a Barnes and Noble knockoff in the movie, and it's like, why are my books in the black studies section? This is fiction. What is that doing here? Which was definitely a funny scene to bring up, but I think what he gets upset with is, and now we can talk about the author plot line, is while he's at this literature review in Boston, he encounters a conference for this major bestseller by this author, Centaurea Golden, played by Issa Rae. And it's this very like crass, trauma porn, reductive book. I'm not going to say the title. I feel bad saying it. it just feels so racist, but it's like,
I think you should say it.
All right. So, and this is the name from the original book that this movie is adapted from. So it is a best-selling novel in the plot of the movie called We's Lives in the Ghetto. And all the characters are like stereotypical in like dire situations. The plot is like trauma porn. They're all speaking in like broken Ebonics. And it's also like, it's the kind of thing where like, if you can pick up on this, the kind of writing is also very bad and poorly researched, you know, like they're using like slang from different cities in the same sentence, intentionally misspelling and mispronouncing things, just bringing up like drugs, crime, pain and suffering for like no reason other than like pure shock. And he sees this like white, I mean, it's not even like a mostly white audience, like it's all sorts of people really like eating it up and cheering for it as this excerpt is being read aloud. And he's like justifiably bewildered and upset that it's getting this kind of attention. And he doesn't like express it clearly, but he says it clearly enough to me, at least, which is like, is that all that people want to see? They just want to see trauma porn. They don't want to actually see like anything transcendent of that, or anything that breaks the mold in that way.
Yeah, and it's really funny / fucked that the original book, when the Weez lives in the ghetto, that book is based off of Push by Sapphire, which is the book. Yes, which is the book that the movie Precious is based off of.
And Precious is literally trauma porn in the movie.
Yes. And so is the book. So like, that's the thing, and why it's so funny that this book was made in 2001 is the 90s had, for lack of a better reason, I'm going to say some type of renaissance. And it's like the renaissance was like hip hop literature, for lack of a better, like if I'm trying to explain it in a way that is understandable, it was a lot of black artists writing about black people, but it all felt like a minstrel. If I'm being honest, and I do think it's important because, in my opinion, black people are allowed to have bad art as well.
Mm-hmm.
We are allowed to make good and bad art. We are allowed to learn from the said art. People are allowed to spoof said art and make something that is better or different. But especially Sapphire, she has written a lot of books that are based on Black experiences, and she is a Black woman herself, but you have these feelings, and you can tell that she has gone through things, but just because you've gone through things doesn't mean that you are the voice of all Black people, nor should you be seen like that or allow people to see you like that, especially white people. Yeah.
I was trying to like find the name of the author in question here, because like I'm mad that I can't remember this name, because it's like not just like the books you're referencing here, but they had the son of this guy on that goofy ass show Killer Mike did on Netflix a few years ago. They even like made fun of it on like they made fun of it on Luke Cage too, where it's just like these like tales of the hood, so to speak.
Yes.
And like it's sold maybe initially to a Black audience, or maybe it's sold for like a limited thing, but then when white people get the ability or the access to consume it, it's like, I don't know, me and you have talked about this thing of like pulling back the curtain, right? Like, you know, The Sopranos was, you know, David Chase pulling back the curtain on white people, so to speak. Dave Chappelle might have been acting way too out of pocket because he was pulling back the curtain on Black people for a white audience. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, I feel like a very reactionary wing of people who insist stand-up comedy is free speech, you know? I don't know how best to describe it other than foolishness to some extent, right? But, or just shit that doesn't matter. But it's like, they insist they understand Black culture because they saw what Dave Chappelle was willing to show them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing about pulling back the curtain is, who's committing the act of pulling back the curtain? What was their artistic intent for doing so? And more broadly, you know, is it someone with a leg up on somebody pulling the curtain and showing someone that they're, you know, stepping over to do so, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think like you said, with it being like a minstrel show to some extent, right? In you know, the minstrel shows of old, it's caricatures or, you know, ridicule of Black people for the entertainment of white people that further reinforces stereotypes and just general, like, you know, contempt and disrespect, right? But then I think with this genre of trauma porn and pulling back the curtain in a negative capacity, you actually are not having the frank discussion of pain or suffering or inequality or injustice that you think you're having. But what you are doing is offering a minstrel show to a certain kind of white person who sees it as intellectual stimulation, or sees it as a way to perform what they may see as a good deed, or may present themselves as cultured for doing so. When the reality is that you have only selectively shown something that does not offer the truth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was a very verbose way of trying to get at what this film is trying to show us. But I mean, it's incredibly goofy the way that Issa Rae's character goes about it. And there's even like this like really iconic scene in this movie where, like, I don't know if you missed it. It was in the same scene where, like, we see his like lacrosse bats and we see the Harvard posters, but he's like watching TV in his room, and you can see this ad for like celebrating Black History Month on this movie channel, and like the movies are like The Color Purple, 12 Years a Slave, The Help, Precious. And he just sees it, like, you just see like the just the pained expression on his face that he turns the TV off, right? So while all this is going on, while he's dealing with all his family trauma, he has the opportunity as part of a book review to be a judge for some book award. And actually, wait, we missed a big fucking step. Let me step back, right? So while he's pissed about Issa Rae's character's book in this movie, he decides he needs to talk to his publisher about it. And his publisher's like, well, listen, this is what white people want. You got to give them what they want. So he says, fuck it. You know, he has a drink, decides to write one of these very stereotypical trauma porn narratives. I'm blanking on the name of that author because it reads a lot like what he would have written. And maybe I stop for a bit. Hang on.
What are you talking about?
I'm trying to figure out like which author in particular they were trying to kind of make fun of, because I know the genre as a whole they're trying to make fun of, which is like gang fiction, but there's like a particular author style I think they were trying to make fun of here, but I can't name the author here.
I mean, I think it's all like the same.
Yeah,
like,
I think
it's like it's Sapphire, it's like all of those people. They aren't like, yeah, some of it might deal with gang and some of it might deal with like sexual assault, but none of it ever deals with class dynamics. Like, no exactly. One ever talks about like, oh, this shit happens because Reagan fucking sucks, or like, this shit happens because of poverty. Like, in Precious, they do talk about AIDS and HIV, but they don't talk about how HIV is prevalent in the Black community because of certain things and like all of this other stuff. It really just talks about how just the basicness of like Black people sometimes live in the ghetto and they are poor, and not like, why is that? No one ever talks about what brings people to a situation where they are in need and they turn to gangs and they turn to all of this stuff. And it's always like, hi, can we get something that's entertaining, especially to white people, make them like just slightly tug on their heartstrings without making them want to actually do something about it, and just take them out of their life while they pay attention to this on the beach somewhere during their vacation.
I finally got it. I'm talking about Donald Goines.
I truly don't know the specific names. The only person I really know is Sapphire. I move all of that information has been taken out of my brain pre like 2015.
Yeah, because like Sapphire's books definitely like they appeal to more like the, I wouldn't say like this is solely a female audience, but like it kind of
a female middle class Black and white But like, you know, like demographic, it is, some of this stuff has a very big demographic. They want Black people to read it, because if Black people read it, then it's cool enough for white people to read.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I feel about like Donald Goines' books. Where like, because again, they made fun of it in like Luke Cage. They even had like the guy's son on in like that Killer Mike docuseries on Netflix, right? And he's like kind of considered influential in like how Black gang violence is depicted in fiction, at least in the way that white people choose to depict it, right?
Like, oh, he's from Detroit.
Yeah, died in Highland Park. You feel me? So like, mm-hmm. It's like the thing that I get right about an author like Donald Goines is like, you know, a work like The Wire, even if it's really good, right, has a white director at the helm. Where do you think he got the idea?
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely Donald Goines, right? So I feel like the work that Monk tries to come up with an American Fiction, when he's confronted with this really gross thing that Issa Rae's character has wrote and gotten way too much fame and success over, he decides, I'm going to write a Donald Goines style crime like story called, I feel horrible saying this out loud, My Pathology.
With an F.
And it's like, it's like a really comical scene of like him trying to write it, and then he's visualizing the characters like having a confrontation, and like the characters will be like doing some like they'll be saying like really like corny out of pocket lines, they'll be shooting each other, and they'll be like, hey yo, so what do I say next? Like it was funny how it was carried out. He writes it expecting it to go nowhere, just like, you know, as a FU to his editor. And his editor's like, his publisher. So his publisher's like, no, actually, people really fucking like this. And he wrote it under a pen name. And they were talking about, well, listen, they want to pay you like a huge amount of money for it. They want film rights, all of this shit, right? So he decides to publish it under a fake name, and they come up with this whole story about him being this like, you know, fugitive. And he's trying to like run this double game of this, trying to make some money publishing this honest to God awful story that he hates that he even wrote. And he's dealing with like upper crust like white liberals in the publishing biz and the film industry who are like really patronizing to him and are trying to like, I don't know how to say it. Like, the disdain is palpable, but it's also completely ignorant. Any appreciation that they have for it is sincere in like the worst possible way. You know, mm-hmm. what I'm saying? It's to gawk, it's to ogle. And he resents that he has to even play this role. He resents that he even had to write the dang thing. But it's giving him like the vital income he needs to take care of his aging mother and like deal with some of these lapsing financial issues as a consequence of his dad's absence, you know, his dad's death and his sister's death. So while this is all going on too, he gets the opportunity to be part of a panel for a book award, and joining him on the panel is Issa Rae's character Centara Golden, who he has a clear bone to pick with. And also, as a consequence of his book getting published under a pseudonym, it actually ends up being considered for these awards that he's on the panel for. which was a brilliant bit of dramatic irony for this plot.
It was literally so funny to see.
Like, people will be like, dude, it took you an hour to explain all this. I'm like, yes, the plot is that fucking complicated.
And it's so in depth because the only reason he's on like this committee is because, one, he needs the money and he loves to judge other people's work.
Right.
Like, which honestly, if you're lying if you say that you are a writer and you don't love to judge other people's work, because it is quite literally a part of your education that you are going to get if you get an education like as a writer. Is not only do you have to write, but you have to peer read everybody's or majorities of people in your class's stuff. And that's whether you take a official writing class or if you join like a little small writing group, you're going to have to read and judge people's work. So honestly, writers, if a writer says that they don't love to do that, they're lying to you. They really are. So he has that opportunity to judge these other books, and he never thinks that his book, his secret book, is going to be a contender because they had already been receiving all of these books before his book ever got on the market. And he changed the name of his book to Fuck at like the last moment before they actually went to publishing because he thought that his white
patrons.
Yeah. Well, no, he thought that the people who were like the higher ups were going to say no.
Right.
And he used that as his like deal breaker. There's no way. And he's like, they're like, can we make it Fuck with a P? And he's like, no, I want it to be Fuck. I want the title of the book to be Fuck. And he thinks that they're going to be like, oh, that's too much. That's too abrasive. That's too black. And they're like, it's too much. It's too abrasive. It's black. We love it. We're going to name your book Fuck. So every time he tries to out-ridiculous the system, it throws him for a curveball and be like, no, this is exactly what we want. And when he was first told that he got a book deal, he thought it was with one of his serious works that he's been working on. And no, it was with something that he, I think, probably spent a night writing that is literally like a joke. And this is where, like, this is what they decide to take serious. And every time that he's in a room where they're talking about this book, he's trashing on it. He's disgusted by it, like actively disgusted by it. He makes sure he lets everyone know in every single situation where this book is around him that he dislikes it. And it's so crazy because he is the author. And not only is he the author, he's taking that lucrative check that he's getting that he never got with any of his other serious work. And he's able to put his mother in a nursing home where she gets round-the-clock care because her Alzheimer's is getting worse.
Yeah.
And it's just like, he's so he's so disgusted by who he is and who the system is and the industry, but not disgusted enough to walk away and never disgusted enough to stop. But completely disgusted enough not to put his name on it.
Which is like a real like bind they put him in because it's like he has a demonstrable need for that money. It's not even for him. It's like to keep his family afloat, right?
Right.
Which is yeah. how they get you, yeah.
And then, like, that's the thing. It's like, you see this and you're just like, you know, I would do that too. Like, if I was in his exact situation and, like, I had accidentally wrote something that was, I mean, my biggest thing is he didn't ask for enough money. Like, if you're going to sell your soul, whatever amount of money, and this is for everyone, if you're going to sell your soul, whatever they offer, at least ask for double. They got it. And if they don't, they'll let you know. But if it's your morals, and if you're going to feel bad about, like, the amount of money, at least make them give you an amount of money that you won't feel bad about. That's my advice to you. Because literally, like, watching it, and they were like, oh, they're offering you $750,000. I would be like, so that means I'm worth at least a mil and a half. At least. Like, what do you mean? And that was their first offer? You don't ever take the first offer.
But that is the ethical, like, conundrum he's getting faced with. And I think if, I mean, we spent a lot of time on the plot, so I think I'm going to try to wrap this up as smoothly as I can for the plot summary, right? Which is, like, this ethical dilemma, in addition to all his personal problems, it comes to a head with two major conflicts. So the first one that I'll get into is his relationship with Coraline, right? Who has been his steadfast partner through this whole thing, and just a silent, supportive person as he's in this new phase of his life, who has said that, you know, she admires his literature and his opinion as an author, right? He sees the fake book on her table, and then he's like, oh, so this is what you're reading now, you know, like, and they have a confrontation over it, and it's his family pathology, actually, like, his literal pathology, not the fake one, not the pathology. The actual pathology plays out, and it's like he's unable to explain why this book makes him so upset, because he doesn't want to reveal the truth about the double game he's playing. He doesn't, and actually this is the thing, he does not talk to a single person about his beef with Centaurra Golden and, like, her book.
The only person who knows that he wrote this book is his publisher. The publisher. And the really funny thing about the publisher is every time Monk is faced with this idea of, like, I should stop this, or this isn't right, his publisher, who is a Puerto Rican man, is like, no, you should do this, or, like, at least try, or at least do this or do that, like, and it's telling. It's the Puerto Rican homie that gets you in trouble.
It's always the Puerto Rican homie.
And it's just like, and, like, if you are in the idea of just, like, his editor being, like, a Puerto Rican man and not understanding the exact things that Black people are going through, but then also I'm thinking, like, maybe the publisher, you know, if he's publishing art, like, writers like him, they don't got that much money. Like,
no, it was a blink and you miss it line where he's like, yeah, they're not ready for the truth about Black people. And he said it, like, I think they're not ready to see how we live, right? Like, he says that. Then in another line, he's like, if I knew this, my parents would have never immigrated here from Puerto Rico, right? Like, or they would have moved here from Puerto Rico. So it was like a blink and you miss it line. I don't think, like, him being Puerto Rican super important to the plot, but it's like,
no, there's I don't think it's
these realistic, like, depictions of, like, how complex Black life actually is, even in a place like Boston.
Yeah, and I think it's the other like funny thing is like he understands a lot of the race dynamics, but he doesn't understand all of them. And that's, and when Monk is like, no, this is too much, this is, I feel like I am selling out, he doesn't see all of the ways that that could be true because he's not black. And but he also relates to him in a way that he, like, that another person can't, like a white publisher couldn't, because he is Puerto Rican.
Right.
So I think this movie is very loud and subtle at the same time. They're one of the like head publishers, and the first time we saw her, white lady, like she had RBG in like the like,
oh my god, yeah,
like, posters on her wall, and then the next time we see her with like the gay publisher, and he's just like extra and like, yes honey girl, yes, slay and everything, and it's just like, oh my god. Like that wasn't on accident. Like those people were cast for that, well, because that is important to show, like, those are the people who are in the industry and this is how they act.
Yeah, it's, and I think that's the whole like meta theme of the film, right? Is that regardless of how complex Black people's lives are, in a day-to-day banal sense, they have to be flattened, they have to be stereotyped, they have to be not only cheapened, but they have to be sensationalized, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where, like, and I think he does spell that out to some extent at some point in the film, right? Where it's like, it's flattening, it's cheapening, it doesn't represent the complexities of our lives, which is, mm-hmm. And like, you see that in like these very like, subtle, overtures and like, discussions in the film, right? Like colorism is a thing that probably happens in his family, you know, his, mm-hmm. Was his brother singled out for being gay, or was his brother singled out for being like dark skinned? You don't know, but it's something you can think about, right? If you're familiar, mm-hmm. with it. So, there's a lot, like you just like this. I mean, you know, our friends Zareen and Justin, who recommended this film, like I wanted to even read some of their thoughts as like we were talking about some of this, right? So Zareen was saying this, where it's like, another thing, I feel like his life was so interesting, and I've seen tons of white movies like that, just dealing with parents getting ill, death, cheating, etc. But it made me realize Black movies with similar content won't get as popular, specifically because people want to see these over-sensationalized stories with Black people rather than, you know, slice of life stories, which is fucked up. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's not just in the context of the movie as we see it, it's even within the world and scope of the movie itself, where anything pertaining to complexity is not relevant. And I think like the term trauma porn is kind of telling, right? There's like the old I forget which Supreme Court case it was about like setting a precedent for what obscenity is, right? And one of the justices, I forget who, like, it's in the record of like, well, porn is, you know it when you see it. And it's like, in the same way that like pornography can flatten like the human sexual experience, or like how we talk about love, gender dynamics, all that stuff, right? It's the same thing with like these trauma porn stories that they're criticizing in this film, and that Monk was visibly opposed to in the film, right? Is that its sole purpose is to entertain than to provoke thought.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, be transcendent in any way. And that's kind of where you have to figure out the line, is like, where is an author just an entertainer and where is the author doing something transformative? Is it pretentious to think in those terms? Is it not? There's a big metatextual discussion at the heart of the film because of stuff like that. And for him to feel the pressure of those questions but be unable to communicate those to his loved ones, it's something that his, you know, his suffering mother, because like she's really lost at this point in the movie, right? She tries to chalk it up to him like being a genius in some sense, and because like he feels these pressures and considers these questions, it makes him unable to communicate with other people. But I think to a lesser extent, it's also like, how often do people who consider these questions actually make it accessible, or how often do they try to get other people to think in these ways? Mm-hmm. I think it's two-sided, right? Like, these are problems I've had in my own life. Not that I consider myself a genius at all, right? But when you think about, like, what is the purpose of art? What is the nature of it? It's more than just, like, something you say to sound interesting at a cocktail party. It's something that, like, I feel like I grapple with a lot. What is the purpose of doing this podcast? It's something I grapple with, like, as we're doing it right now. And how do you get people to think about that? How do you even say anything insightful about it? It's tricky. So that's one conflict he's grappling with. The other one is he actually gets to confront Issa Rae's character in this literature board review. And I think that was probably like the deepest consideration of these questions in the film. And also, like, I think it was my favorite scene. Because it's just the two of them sitting in a quiet room. There's no other white people jumping in yet. It's over like a really shitty lunch, you know, like she has like a shitty sushi bowl and like a GT's like kombucha. And he has like Caesar salad in a box. You know,
right? Like, it's so gross looking.
Like, they're both upper class in some way, but he's like this older, downwardly mobile beast who, like, I say beast in the sense of like he's more gruff. He's not in the mainstream. He's not being recognized as like having merit in some modern context, right? And her, she's like the new thing that everyone likes. And she's selling trauma porn to the masses, right? So she's more recognizable to like a like, I don't want to write her off as like she's Gen Z coded. I don't think, but like she's definitely like the newer breed of author, especially as the tendency to bow more fully to market forces has taken over publishing, has taken over media. They have this intense, but quiet, like they're not really shouting. They're not getting angry or worked up, but there is like a deep, ferocious, like, spirited character to their discussion. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves you feeling like everything that Issa Rae's character says is empty, it's hollow, but it's not wrong. A lot of people have gotten successful with that mindset, and a lot of people do it. More than that, are even encouraged to do so. And what she says to him at the end of the discussion, like, you know, she insists that she researched it well, and he calls bullshit. I think he's correct to call bullshit on it. Then she's like, well, you know, if the audience wants it, who am I to deny them? Right?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know how to answer that question, but he still says that, like, you know, you deny black people potential by writing them so flatly like this. And then she says something that I think is like I personally think is a brilliant line because it captures like how cynical her character is, but also like this is a tactic that is used to shut down anybody with a progressive point of view or anybody who like is taking like a principal position, right? Which is like you try to like shake their conviction very violently because you're cynical, right? So he's talking about the potential and like the hope for freedom, for coming out of the backward condition that America has imposed on Black people, and that, you know, we don't have to be stereotypes. We can be complex. We can be characters of depth in the same way that white characters get to be in literature, right? Mm-hmm. And she says, well, isn't potential something you see and something you don't like? Is there something to that effect, right?
Yeah.
And it like leaves him stunned. And when while he's stunned, the other white judges in the panel come in, and the two of them even like, so him and Issa Rae's characters both like agree that Fuck is a horrible book. They don't like it. But then when he tries to press her on like, but didn't you write the same book? Which is, I think, this is basically what like Zareen said too, and this is what I said, right? The hypocrisy of writing an over-sensationalized book, but then being offended by Jeffrey Wright's book was wild. I felt very capitalism vibes from that moment.
Yeah, and
it was capitalism. Well, like, it is like
it is, but like it's so interesting in this moment for so many ways, but I don't know if he actually read her book. I think he just read excerpts of her book or listened to that excerpt, and he decided what he felt about the book. And I know my initial thought of like a book being called Weez Lives in the Ghetto, like I know what my initial thoughts are, but I like when she started to talk about how she did research, I started to think about Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston and how she actually did do a lot of research in anthropology, and her book in places is written phonetically, and that is something that people had to say about her book when it first came out. But I think her book is different because she never went into the rural South like looking for information to write a fictional book. Like she went down in like a very anthropologic like type of deal. Like she was actually going there to study Black people that have not, like, there was no real education known about them. So in that moment, I'm like, are we doing like that? Are we just being like haters to how people were haters to Zora Neale Hurston? Or is it really like, be fucking for real? You went into the ghetto so you can hear Black people. And her and Monk had very similar backgrounds.
But she's richer than him too. And I think they get at that too, right? But it's like, she's
Is she richer than him because her book is successful?
I think it was something to do with her background. Like she had an even better pedigree than him. And because she came from newer money, like she's not as downwardly mobile yet.
Well, that's the thing is, I don't know if she went to I think he said she went to Oberon or something. Oberlin. Went to Harvard. Oberlin, sorry.
And Oberlin is like the Death Star of white liberalism, you know, like.
but you went to Harvard and you teach at this like this West Coast, like school, like, that's the thing is, I don't know how much I can understand his judgment to her without seeing it completely be the like him just doing a self-read. Like, it seemed like everything he hated about her is what he hates about him.
And that's a brilliant point. That's a brilliant point. I'm glad you brought that up, because it's like, everyone jumps into the creator space, or they jump into the media space, thinking that they won't make those mistakes, or that they don't embody those negative qualities, or that they're immune to them, right? Mm-hmm. But I think, like, and they don't get that. I mean, they don't spell it out explicitly, but the fact that you thought of that is brilliant. And it's, that's another one of those questions I marinate on a lot, is like, by stepping into the space, I'm no better than anybody else, you know?
Yeah.
I'm subject to the same, like, dark forces and just, like, market-oriented decision-making that everyone else in the space is doing, right? Even if I think I'm better than somebody who does it more blatantly, how much better can I really be?
But, like, especially in his situation where, like, I think... like, there's a chance that Centara, Issa Rae's character, was exactly like him beforehand. The only thing is like, we are seeing her post her successful book, and we are seeing him pre his successful book. But they're both upper middle class. They've had amazing opportunities, and they decide... mm-hmm. that they want to write about Black people who they've never been around. They've never interacted with these type of Black people, but they, because they are still Black, are allowed to pull the curtain on Black people that they don't even know.
Exactly. And I think, like, I don't know, because that, I read Issa Rae's character as 100% cynical. Maybe there's a read where, like...
but is it Monk? They're both cynical.
They're both cynical, right? But I think, like, there was just certain lines where it's like, she says, well, isn't potential, like, what you ascribe to somebody who has failed you in some way, right? Or even, like, she kind of cynically deploys, well, isn't this you just picking on a Black woman? And I'm like...
but then also, isn't it?
And that's the thing, right? Is like, when you come at an individual as the avatar of the systemic failures of a whole industry, right? Which in this case is books and publishing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to universally ascribe the whole failure to them. But also, mm-hmm. like, I think it's like, it's twofold, like you're saying, right? Where it's like, who's the real villain here? Issa Rae's character or the white publishers?
I think it's the publishing sphere. I think it's the real villain is entertainment.
And I agree with that. I do agree with that. But I think, like, Monk's, like, perspective going in, because he doesn't tell anybody this shit in the, like, as a consequence of his character, right? And if he was able to talk about this with somebody, I think maybe he'd come out of it with a systemic critique, who knows? But he goes in, like, trying to, like, make her the avatar of everything he hates about this industry.
Mm-hmm.
But never once does he engage with the white power holders, even under his real name.
Yeah. And that's why I'm, like, especially, like, is he mad at her because of what she's doing, or is he mad at her because he's doing it too?
And I think that's the sticking point that I think viewers might disagree on for good reasons, right? Do you read Issa Rae's character as 100% cynical? I did, but I can now see the read where it's like, maybe she wasn't. Do you see him? Do you see Monk is 100% sincere? I did at first. Looking at this now, like, yeah, he probably, even if he meant what he said, was not aware of his own complicitness in its full extent until like that confrontation happened. So I think you're spot on with where you're coming from with this. And I think like that's why this movie is so brilliant, but also like that confrontation in the movie is probably my favorite scene in it.
Yeah, it's definitely needed, especially because he was just going to continue to get all of this money and be seen as this person without any other idea. Like he was okay with that until this moment happened. Well, this moment and him winning the award.
Yeah. So with that, the movie does kind of do an open-ended ending for the film. Why did I say that so dumb? They take the possibility of multiple endings where basically now that the fake book he's written is going to get turned into a film, he has no choice but to figure out how he's going to write the ending. So he decides to tell the story of how he did all this as a script idea to one of the white film. I think it was only, yeah, there's only one. Yeah. So there's a film director he's in talks with. And that guy is like a classic caricature of Hollywood, right? And he decides to sell the plot of how this ends. So he tries to end it on like, you know, does he, when it's time to give the book fucking award, he stays quiet at first. I think that's one of the endings. And then they're like, no, you can't do that. Then the other one is like, he tries to reconnect with Coraline. Oh, no, sorry. So the first ending is he tells the truth that he's the author of Fuck. And then they say, no, you can't do that ending. Then he tries to do the ending where he walks out of the award ceremony, tells Coraline the truth, and then it fades to black. We don't know if she reconciles with him or not. Again, this ending doesn't work for the director's purposes. So
yeah,
the
it's
ending,
too romantic comedy, he says. It's and it's just like, and it's just this idea. When he said that, it like pissed me off because there aren't that many black romantic comedies, and there are so many people who are just like, can you please just cast a romantic comedy with black people? They can even be in an interracial like relationship if you want. But like, can you please just put black people can't fall in love. We got to be in the streets and the ghetto and getting all these diseases and all, like, it's never just like, hey, black people, romantic comedy, that's it. And when it is, it's almost never talked about or liked, or it never gives enough recognition as all of the other romantic comedies that you see. And it's like, what's wrong with this being a romantic comedy?
Yeah, yeah. And the ending that the director does actually like instead of that one, because even though it's a quote unquote romantic comedy ending, I actually found it incredibly satisfying, right? Which is that he finally accepts that this whole literature thing is bullshit. He walks out and then he goes back to Coraline, which is the person who supported him through all this. And he decides like, fuck it, it's time I like step into the light and tell her the truth. And then instead of giving us like a, you know, does she forgive him? Does she not forgive him? It just fades to the night sky over like the beach town they're in, right? Which I thought would be a brilliant way to end it. Still not enough for the white director. So the ending they choose to go with is he gets up on stage to confess that he's the author. Doesn't work because the FBI buys into the idea that he actually is a fugitive, because that's the backstory they gave the pseudonym. and he is shot in cold blood by the police. And the movie ends on like, or sorry, the fake movie, the movie within the movie ends on that note. And the white director is like, oh my God, this is perfect. And he's just so satisfied that he has trauma porn to end his movie on, right? This is like, if this is trauma porn, this is the money shot. And he's happy, he gets it. And Monk walks out dejected, except he doesn't walk back out into Boston. He walks out on like a studio set, and Cliff is there to pick him up. And, you know, they're talking about, like, you know, how, like, this L.A. stuff is too crazy or whatever. Like, they're just shooting the shit. And he sees a black actor on the set in, like, a slave outfit. It's so bad. And the two of them just, like, and they share a nod, like, they understand each other. And he drives off with his brother away from the studio lot into the sunset. And I think like that ending is like him, I don't know if it's, you can interpret it this way, but I think it's him accepting that like, we're just entertainers at the end of this, huh?
Yeah, it's really fucked and funny the way it ends, because we don't know about Coraline. His sister's dead. Him and his brother seem like they could be like coming up with a better relationship, but his brother still is divorced and his kids hate him because they've been getting picked on because their dad got caught having an affair with a man.
Right.
And like but at the end of the day, he got a book deal and a movie deal, and he's going to be able to pay for his mom.
And like to that end, like Justin also mentioned something in his thoughts, right? Is like, it felt like at times the fact that he wrote the book didn't even matter to that plot, which adds to the trippiness of this whole movie. Like they might've just added it to grab more viewers, but then like using the book plot only to then not commit to an ending. Doesn't that feel a lot like life in some way?
Mm-hmm.
It feels a lot like not only the literary process and writing itself, right? Where it's like, how am I supposed to end this shit? And if that question of how you end it isn't even in your hands, it's in the hands of your publisher or a director. Well, I mean, you leave that just feeling empty as an artist, I imagine. But then it's kind of indicative of the circumscription of choice for black people in America, right? You know, your choices and how you're perceived and how people will react to you have already been preordained by white society in some extent. So fuck, man, what a brilliant movie. Oh my God, we've been at this for a while, so I don't know. I think we talked a lot about themes and motifs. I know I mentioned my favorite movement, or sorry, favorite moment in the film. What was your favorite scene?
That's a good question.
I also got to wrap up in 30 minutes, sorry.
I really loved the scenes with Moraine in them. I think like especially the fact that at the end she fell in love, and it was like at the beginning, well, first I automatically resonated to her. I'm like, that's like, she reminds me of my mom, my aunts, like stuff like that, like just loving and caring and cooking and all this other stuff, taking care of the home. And at first, I was like so scared that they were just going to drop her because they were running out of money and the mom needed to be put in like a home and all this other stuff. So it was just like, oh no, like they're gonna drop her. She's been taking care of them her whole life, their whole lives, and now she's going to be just dropped at the end. But she ended up falling in love and like being with a good man and like having her happy ending and her happy ever after. And that truly made me so happy, because just characters like her and how she's basically like their mammy, like it, those characters never get satisfying endings. Like,
yeah, they're always flattened into being a matron or like into a maternal character, right?
Yeah, and like especially like, I mean, like, especially you'll get on TikTok and there'll be like these people who are like, my nanny going home to insert country here after spending 20 years with us, and like she gets to go home and be with her family and her children. It's like she couldn't she didn't have the ability to take care of her children because she was too busy taking care of you guys to make a decent living. And like it's so like, we don't know if Lorraine had children, and I think most likely she didn't, because they never bring mention them. And I think the children with her were her children. She was their maternal figure, and instead of being left while they needed to take care of their actual maternal figure, she was still loved, and she got the opportunity to have like an actual relationship and be with people, and get shown that love by them as well. And it was, that was very surprising.
Yeah, those things were very wholesome. They were very incredibly wholesome. And I think there's something to be said about like, they still consider her and Maynard family, even like, though they might have been the help, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's kind of funny how like, as the Ellison family, as they're downwardly mobile and as they're like sundowning into more problems, she's in a new chapter of her life and like experiencing new joys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like that's, it just goes to show like how complex Black life is, where it's like, here you are in middle age finding, you know, a new love and getting married, and you know, these kids that you were charged with taking care of might still be dysfunctional, but you're still in a position to be loving and supportive of them, but also on your own terms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, I mean, I don't know. We've talked about this plot in circles, right? And this, for a 2-hour movie, a lot happened.
Yeah.
a surprising amount of stuff happened in 2 hours, right? But it's, it does not go out of its, it makes sure to go out of its way to demonstrate just how complex Black people's lives are, and how it's, I think if you take Monk's side in the dispute that we mentioned earlier, you can see his perspective on why it would be so reductive and so damaging to flatten people's lives into stereotypes. And even like, as you were mentioning earlier, like this is just a separate side tangent now, right? Where it's like, he seems incredibly averse to using trauma or using pain as a motivating factor or as an inciting incident in his own writing, it seems. Like, he had a traumatic, you know, memory of his father's suicide. He saw his sister die of a heart attack, right? So for him to quietly deal with those things and like kind of resent people who've presented so flagrantly, there's like a separate discussion going on there too of like, how do we talk about the complexities of sadness and joy? at the same time in people's lives, and even how do we represent those tastefully and tactfully in art, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think in terms of performances, what did you think?
I think they all did absolutely amazing.
I agree. I don't think there was a single weak link in this film, but
no, it was wonderful.
It's a very brilliant drama. I think everyone involved did a great job. And I think it's good that I saw this film around the same time I saw this new show that's out on Crave. What is it? Late Bloomer. Where I think like a lot of artists of color not only are making it into the foreground, but then in addition to talking about, you know, ethnic or cultural challenges, they're even now in a position to speak candidly and openly about problems within the space of art, within the space of content production, within media as a whole, right? And I don't know where I intended to go with that, right? But I think it's just like, I love seeing a film or picking up a book or just running into something that captures some of the questions or feelings I've been dealing with, right? Mm-hmm. And both those works, but especially this movie, right? I don't know if they soothed any pains for me, but it's very vindicating and reassuring when people with deeper experience than you, with more talent and with more command over how they communicate things to you with language, with their art, whatever it may be, if they're dealing with the same challenges, the same frustrations, the same questions, even if they don't have an answer, it's still reassuring to know that someone has thought of this, that someone is dealing with this as well. And I think tying this back in a beautiful bow, right? That is the need for representation in media. That is why people seek it. Even if it's corny, even if it's not the most important thing materially, or whether it's dealt with in severely cringeworthy ways at times, right? People want to be validated. People don't want to feel alone. And I think this film powerfully captures so many of those ideas and questions. And I think it deserves all the praise it's getting. It deserves all the hype. And again, I'm very excited to see what Cord Jefferson pulls off in his future projects. I think this was a brilliant film.
Yes, it's an amazing debut.
I think someone in a review of the movie was saying that, like, if your first film is an indication of what you're trying to say as an artist, then Cord Jefferson picked up a megaphone. So yeah, I think, I don't know, we can probably get into rating the film. Do you have any other thoughts you want to share with us? I don't want to cut you off too quick.
Other than, it's just really good. And if you want to watch a film that's really good, I think you should watch it.
Yeah, I love dramas as a genre, right? Like White Lotus is probably like the most camp variation we have in today's media of camp dramas. But then like things like this that toe the line between meta commentary and, you know, family drama, and can weave slice of life into satire and social issue dramas, right? It takes a lot of skill to pull that off as a director, and then for the cast to like be on the same page and deliver in every scene, right? So to orchestrate something like that, beautiful. Mwah, I love it. I think our scale for movies, I keep forgetting if we use 5 or 10s. Let's use 5s for this one. I think this is, I don't think it's high. I don't think it's exaggeration to do this. I think this one deserves a 4.5 out of 5. Easy.
Yeah.
It's blessed, bro. It's blessed. So, thanks again for tuning in, dear listeners. We'll try not to have so much of a delay between our future episodes, but we're doing the best, and we know you are too. So you can tune in to our show on every other podcast platform that's still up, as long as the internet continues to function. And if we have any links, you can find them in the link tree in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in, dear listeners. We'll see you on the next one. Take care.